Hey guys, really happy to have Tavi Costa on board. He's been churning out some amazing visuals of where we truly are at macroeconomically. Tavi is a partner and macro strategist with Crescat Capital. Tavi, welcome. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me, Francis. Looking forward to this.
You put some really nice visualizations together about what's been going on macroeconomically. A couple of things. I mean, we get data and we see numbers, but I've always found the visuals help with other people that are maybe a little bit less technocratic, a little bit less fundamental. One of which was the income receipts from taxation, how that is plummeting and is actually at or beyond previous major recessionary stroke depressionary lows, including the dot-com boom and the subprime crisis boom. We included those in our Substack, by the way, and credited you. What's your take on the state of the American finances? We also had the news with regard, sorry, I'm a bit extending this, of the trillion needed for quarter three and I suspect an optimistic 850 billion for quarter four. So almost 2 trillion to finish the year in terms of deficits spending. Where are we at?
Well, look, so far we've had estimates of about $1.2 trillion for the whole year. And so far, we've seen about $1.3 trillion since the debt ceiling was resolved. So far, they have estimated that we're going to see another $1.85 trillion. So that's going to get us above about $3 trillion for the whole year. And again, remember, estimates with 1.2 not too long ago, and now we're about $3 trillion. So things change, and I'm not sure I'm the one to really believe what the government expects when it comes to treasury issuances. But this is such a fundamental issue in the global economy, because everything is tied to the risk-free rate. Everything is tied to 10-year yields and other yields in the treasury market. And to me, this is an important concept, because if you looked at the overall government right now, it's not like they are improving their government or the collection of taxes. And the whole point about that chart, it wasn't just from a federal level, but even from a local and state government side, you're seeing major declines at recessionary levels from almost every state in the U.S. And so it is very concerning of how we're going to be, this is a long-term problem, how we're going to be paying for the debt, but it's starting to become a short and medium-term problem when it comes to the number of issuances that we're seeing of those instruments. And that pairs well with the fact that we are not seeing the Fed step in and buy those treasuries. In fact, they're allowing those instruments to mature. And keep in mind that about 45% of the overall debt in the U.S. today, so it's about $32 trillion, say 45% of that has to be rolled over, meaning they're going to be maturing in less than 2 years. So that means 15 months ago, most of that debt was being issued near 0% interest rates. Right now, we're about 5+% depending on the duration. Some others is 3-4%. And so that is a real problem that will likely, constrain policymaking and even seeing interest payments really surge, especially relative to other parts of the fiscal agenda.
Wow, there's so much to unpack in all of that. In short, we've known we've been building up a big long-term problem, but what you're saying is that is now coming right at us, fourth and foremost. And the big question everybody always wonders is, with all of this new debt issuance, and I'm always making the point, it's not actually international markets anymore that are supporting the U.S. anymore. Who is the buyer of last resort? Is it the Fed itself? Where is all these instruments going? Who's holding what we perceive as toxic assets potentially as the final toxic bank? Who is it?
Well, there's different parts of the market that supposedly can support the treasury, those treasuries demands. And some of that can come from banks. Some of that can come from other pension institutions and other financial institutions that are required to own some of some treasuries in their books. And central banks, foreign institutions in general, are also some of those that purchase those treasuries. But we're not seeing any of that in a increase, and therefore why that has been pressuring 10-year yields higher in the last months or so. And I think that will continue to pressure that the excess of supply will likely continue to pressure the cost of debt much higher. But there's something happening that I think it's even more important is this divergence of policies happening from a monetary and fiscal side, which we haven't seen really throughout the past, meaning the Fed is attempting or hiking interest rates at the steepest manner we've seen in at least in recent history, at the same time shrinking their side of the balance sheet. So if you look at the government or the Fed's ownership of the federal debt, it's been plunging. It's now below 20%. In fact, if you assume that their holdings in terms of value is also shrinking because they don't report that in their balance sheet, then you're saying probably we're about 60% of the overall federal debt. And so if that's the case, then and you look at the cost of debt increasing, at some point, something's got to give. To your point, yeah, ultimately, I think the Fed is responsible for stepping in and being the buyer of last resort. And if that's the case, then a lot of things will be impacted in financial markets. One of them will be tangible assets. And what's shocking to me is that in such an intricate macro environment that we have currently, we're also seeing a very large amount of investors being skeptics about owning tangible assets like gold and commodities. And some people will say, no, I'm seeing folks actually talk about those instruments. Well, it's not true, because when you look at the most conventional and traditional portfolio positioning, which is called the 60-40 portfolios, they own 0% of gold and commodities. And so to me, this is almost, it is the whole reason why I think that part of the market or the segment of market, particularly natural resource industries, will do so well in the next decade or so.
I agree. In actual fact, we'd call the turning in the natural gas actually bottom. We've got an inverted head and shoulder. I'm trying to share a chart as well. I'm not sure if it's showing. That was your original tax incomes part. I think because I made you presenter, I may not be able to do that. You may have to send the presenter role back to me. But we've called the bottom on the natural gas with an inverted head and shoulders. We're, of course, going to start heading into the Northern Hemisphere winter. We've seen oil. We were quite concerned for energies in the first quarter going into the second quarter. There was a bit of an overhang. But this time, instead of what we had in the March 2020, where Russia and Saudi didn't play ball, this time they both agreed to cut in production, which kept a support for a period when we were getting, I think, a lot of demand destruction through the interest rate hikes. And now we're actually seeing quite a bit of strength coming through on oil. And we feel the natural gas has turned. It's just triggered that. Let me see if I can share that chart and get your take on that. Because you're a commodity. Is it fair, while I'm fiddling with a chart, is it fair to say you are a macro commodity bull for what's going forward?
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely in that camp. I think, now we can talk about the lack of allocation from portfolios in general into that part of the market. But also, another way to see that is just that CapEx long-term trends that we've seen such a chronic...
Is it fair to say, Tabby, that you're in the commodity bull camp?
Oh, I definitely am. I think there is a lot of reasons to believe in that thesis. And one of them is what I just said, is the sort of misallocation or the lack of allocation of focus and capital towards the natural resource industries. But another thing that is, I think, just as critical and more quantifiable has to do with the aggregate CapEx trends that we're seeing in those industries. The commodity producers have been quite reluctant into spending capital and developing new projects and creating new demand or new supply for resources in general. And so that is, in my view, especially if coming from the mining and energy space, agricultural too, but mining and energy will take a long time for us to see those investments become, ultimately create supply to readjust the market back to other periods. And therefore, why you tend to see such long periods of cycles for commodities. And so I think we're at the very early stages of one. if that's the case, you know, I think Brazilian markets and some other economies that are resource-rich countries will probably do very well in the next years. And so I'm very excited about, you know, ways to really capitalize in this, in those trends.
I agree. I'll just jump in with that energies share that I was threatening earlier, the natural gas market. I'm not sure that chart is now showing. We both organizers now, but we'll edit it in. But it does seem like the natural gas has certainly turned. And of course, we will be going into a winter. And the big point I saw you make in all of that was also the fact that it's become uncool. You've got the BlackRock effect, the ESG effect. And in actual fact, there's been no new investment. So we are actually creating, not only are we underprovided, but we are creating an environment where in new and fresh investment is no longer even encouraged generally. And there's a lot of pitfalls, and they're actually raising the barriers to entry. So if you want to start a new mine, if you want to do any form of global ground-based excavation for resources of any kind, there's a whole swathe now of bureaucracy that has to be negotiated and front-end payments, which pushes out the planning timeline. And that this is causing a greater shunt in the sort of leads and lags response. And that's this will mean we have an extended probable shortfall in terms of energy, because it's going to take much longer to actually bring new supply online.
Yeah, I think you can add to your point as well, three important or relevant factors that are happening along with that. It's, if you looked at the oil and gas operating rates, they've been contracting the most since the lockdowns in the economy back in 2020 during the pandemic recession and so forth, at a period when we've had not only the lockdowns, but also oil prices going negative, a lot of companies going bankrupt in the energy space, and therefore causing the oil and gas operating rigs to contract. And today we're seeing a very similar trend for other reasons. And some of them have to do with government, you know, reinforcements of their own policies against oil and gas investments and so forth. Another thing that is happening has been the strategic petroleum reserves. They have been declining for some time, and that certainly created pressure, downward pressure in oil and gas prices. Recently, we're seeing those trends being reversed, and that is because they don't have a lot more to sell. We're already at 1980 levels in those indicators. And lastly, I would say that there is also the implied demand measurement in the U.S. has been surging recently. Just in the last report, with very large inventory draws that we've had in the last week, we had a surge to all-time highs in implied demand of oil in the U.S. and followed by the largest increase in that weekly basis of implied demand in 26 weeks. Into 26 years. And so, you know, those are all important drivers of this reacceleration of inflation that I think will be also linked to weakness in the equity markets, because as we see inflation reaccelerate, immediately the first thing that comes to mind is how much will the Fed have to change their policies that are currently in line with the steepest rate cuts that we're going to see in the history of the euro dollar contract. You know, we're seeing very large rate cuts already being priced in. So something, again, it's got to give. You're showing the chart of corporate bond yields and suppressed volatility. All of that is going to be impacted by this reacceleration of inflation.
I love that. And this was another of your charts that I truly, truly liked. Why is it that we get that compression on Fed fund rates differential to corporate yields? Fed fund rates essentially being the risk-free rate, we assume, you know, no risk, inverted commas, but corporations obviously having the potential to go bankrupt. Why do we get the compression, though? Should the yields not be expanding in with, should the margin on the additional risk of corporate failure in a rising interest rate environment actually expand? Or is it because they can't afford it and those rates can't be pushed up? Why do you think we get that compression? That's one thing I couldn't fully understand.
Well, I think there's two reasons. And I think today, the reason for that is different. The reason I would explain in the prior eras would be complacency and the fact that you tend to see, yields tend to fall because of a deflationary shock being priced in treasury markets. And because of that, you have, the corporate bond yields starting to become more attractive over time. And so you have a high demand for those instruments, especially coming from pension funds and other endowment funds that are required to have some level of yield. And that's one of the reasons. Now, today is, why do I say it's different? Because this chart, we don't know how corporate bonds will behave in an inflationary era. Corporate bonds only go back really to the late 80s and early 90s. And so we haven't really seen how that will play out. And my guess is that, we're going to see structurally higher cost of debt and cost of capital for corporations. But the problem with this is that, if you look at junk bond yields, for instance, the average yield right now is at about 8 to 9%, depending on the majority of the companies. Obviously, the ones that have more leverage and more risk, they're probably at double digits, and some others are a little lower. But in average, they're about 8 to 9%. And junk bonds, investment grade bonds are closer, as I show in this chart, are at about 5+%. So, when you think about that, that is throughout history, throughout the last 30 years or so, that is much higher than we've seen in many other years. And so that suppression of corporate spreads today is for a lot of people, is a reflection of how loose monetary conditions are. I don't agree with that take, because I actually think monetary conditions are pretty tight. Financial conditions are tight. You may make the point that VIX is very suppressed. I would agree with that. Now, from a corporate spread perspective, I would say that, I expect a credit spread blowout. I do think that if we have a hard landing scenario, I would think that junk bond yields will probably trade at even worse yields, meaning much higher than treasuries over time. So a lot of things to unpack, but it's the same thing as looking at the yield curve inversion problem. Yield curve inversions today are, about the treasury curve is over 90% inverted. And when you analyze that in itself, it's different in 08, it's different than early 2000s. Why? Because at those times, 10-year yields are falling, 30-year yields are falling. Today, it's virtually all treasury yields are rising, but we're still seeing the shorter-term ones invert relative to the longer ones. What does that mean? Well, that is very a classic market behavior that we see during stagflationary environments. Go back to the 70s, and that's certainly the case. So anyways, there's a lot of important readings in macro indicators right now that suggest that this is not 08 or not early 2000s, much more like an inflationary regime. And that's why I believe so much in commodities.
Yeah. No, it makes absolute sense. And we're going to pivot on the commodities, and we'll bring in some topics that are quite key to us, but like the precious metals and other elements. But before we leave that, we've got on this particular chart, the 30-year, actually with its structure technically pointing to 4.75 plus. And on the 10-year, we actually could see, if my draws show up, here they come, that we're actually leaving the 4% level. I'm going to do a little bit of a fat cokey scribble on here to show you the technical justification at a chartist point of view, but that we see going to the gateway of 5% and leaving the 4. This is the 4, this neckline for this kind of W level that we've only really just tested above a couple of times. I call them almost mini icebergs, but that in essence, we've come down revisiting it. I expect us to potentially go 5%. With those technical aspects in mind, and I also like to reduce very tech bonds. People, the everyday man tends to get lost on bonds. They don't understand it. They understand equity is a share in a business like Apple or et cetera. But wouldn't you just say it, with the extent of proliferation that is required, and as you've already highlighted, the amount of old debt that needs rolling, we are sitting almost with too much, such a proliferation of debt, and it's hitting the wall now, that valuations have to collapse. And that should mean one of the biggest concerns for people is that interest rates spike potentially rather than sitting there calling pivots in the rates. In other words, the central bankers' hands will be forced on account of people not being purchasers of debt instruments anymore. How do you deal with the tendency for people to be waiting for a Fed pivot and how that might not occur? Do you see a spike in rates as being the greater threat than a sudden cut?
I do think that what is price and euro dollar curve of the largest rate cuts in history of the contract, I would disagree completely with that market take. I think that there is an opportunity there to believe that the euro dollar curve will steepen. And that just means that instead of having a massive rate cut, we may actually see rate hikes from there. Obviously, I think the rate cuts are too premature because we really haven't seen the equity markets suffer. I mean, if we do see equity markets down 20-30% from these levels, then I would be in the camp that, yes, we need to see rate cuts, but we're not seeing that yet. So I think that's premature to have that view as of now. I think that it's an even better trade rather than betting on the euro dollar curve steepening, which is more of a sophisticated complex way of expressing that view, is perhaps just short the mega caps, is short the NASDAQ, in which a lot of people would disagree with that opinion. I think it's a valid way of hedging a portfolio at this point. And if that's going to be the case, it's just, there's a chart that I put out recently that shows the divergence between treasury markets and NASDAQ, and essentially shows this relationship. Yeah, it's a relationship.
Actually, if I may jump in there, Tabby,
yeah,
we have a kind of very chill, low VIX response, and actually a far more nervous move in terms of volatility on debt markets. And debt markets are always generally... the liar is the equity markets, or the complacent one, isn't it? Because we've actually have this parallel universe where one part of the system is in almost a cautious potential leading to panic state, and they have an absolute benign indifference in the equity market. How long can that continue before equity markets get the wake up, cold bucket of water? Or am I wrong? Is the bond market wrong?
Oh, I don't think we're too far from it. I think we're seeing in the process of some of that already. But that great rotation idea, if you have yields staying higher, structurally higher costs of debt, a secular inflationary period, it's just hard to believe we're not going to see the ongoing rotation out of growth into value stocks. And in the last 9 months or so, we had a complete opposite of that. It made a lot of people believe that that's the end of that rotation process. And I disagree. I think that is just a reflection of inflation decelerating, which caused growth to just outperform value. But now we're in a situation where a lot of people are in the camp of a soft landing and so forth, thinking that just because we haven't seen a hard landing for so many years or for so long, that the probability of one is almost inexistent. And I believe that the fact that it hasn't happened is, in fact, the reason why you should be so concerned. And because on the macro side, we're still seeing a lot of indicators show that we're probably very close to one. Is it the strength of the labor market that matters more than the yield curve inversion, knowing that labor markets are so such a lagging impact in the markets? And yeah. I'm of that view. I think clearly fundamentals are contracting, and I'd much rather buy a market that is cheap. Now, I think you can find, I don't think you can find in Brazil today, companies trading at 2-3 times earnings. Why would you pay 40-50 times earnings? A lot more. There's some companies trading 100 plus times earnings, and a lot of businesses that are actually not even profitable trading for ridiculous multiples. Why? Yeah. Why even spend time there? I mean, it's all about risk adjusted returns, in my view. I mean, yeah, you can take the risk and you've done well and buy mega caps. I'm not sure that the risk was justifiable personally, but I'd rather focus on things that are unloved and to me, look a lot more attractive from a valuation perspective and kind of fit into this macro views that you know, sounds like you have it as well. And so it's to me, it's a much more important way of managing money than just, you know, just thinking about what has happened with mega caps recently. To me, is something I'm not interested in getting involved.
I 100% agree. I think we had peak America extreme valuations, and you need to have that macro global strategy look that clearly Crest Capital appears to have, listening to you, in that you never go wrong if you buy value. I mean, that's the basis of Benjamin Graham and originally Warren Buffett. I don't know what he's become today, but originally when he started, he certainly was able to implement that. And I don't think we get it now. To me, this yield curve inversion, I brought the chart up for you to see. I'm hoping you can spot it okay. I've annotated it quite heavily. This is tens and twos. This is probably the largest yield curve inversion since 89, since Volcker, which points to a whole change. Would you say the greater the inversion, and as a leading indicator that has an immaculate record, the greater the crisis that follows? Do you see a sense of proportionality in that?
Not necessarily. I think that the reason for that has more of probably due to, you know, the fact that the Fed had to do so much of hiking relative to prior cycles because we're in an inflationary time. But I've done a lot of work on yield curve inversions, and I think a lot of people, unfortunately, have such strong opinions about yield curve inversions without potentially understanding that, especially independent yield spreads. So let's just say you're looking at 2 versus 10s, but if you look at 3 months versus 10s and so forth, they all give you kind of different signals, right? So let's just look at this one, for instance. You know, back in 06 or so, we've had the inversion of the yield curve. And, you know, that took another year or so, or maybe even 2 years, depending on the yield spread, until we saw a significant contraction in equity markets. Now, if you look back in the early 2000s, we've had a few inversions before, but the major inversion really happened in the very early 2000s, which coincided with the decline in equity markets. So which one is it? Should we wait a year out to, you know, from those inversions until we get worried about the equity markets? Does that coincide to it? So what I learned by looking at those things is that if you look at all possible spreads of the yield curve, you know, once the combination of those spreads become inverted by above a 70% handle, and this is a lot of empirical analysis we did, essentially you have a hard landing. But a hard landing for a money manager doesn't mean much. Calling a recession itself doesn't necessarily mean equity markets will collapse. The 1989 savings and loans crisis, for instance, didn't cause equity markets to fall more than 20%. So, you know, it wasn't a huge crash, although the economy suffered a lot and commercial real estate and other parts of the market certainly had a lot of issues back then. So how do you really protect a portfolio when you have this magnitude of inversions that we had recently? And the answer that I found, at least by looking back in different eras, not just the last 20 years, but, you know, 50 years of data or so, is that, which is where we have the data for yield curve inversions, is, you know, one can own, you know, gold and can do well, but really there are times when even gold sells off in those periods. So it's really owning gold relative to the S&P 500. It's the gold to S&P 500 ratio or the gold to equities ratio that is, to me, the most appealing way to protect during those periods. And some parts of that, when you have this level of inversions, you start seeing the Fed beginning to not be able to raise rates as much in some cycles that causes gold to rise. Some other periods, you start to see equity markets crumble. That usually causes gold to crumble a little bit, but equity markets fall a lot more, so that ratio rises. And so that ratio is, I think, by far one of the best ways to really avoid getting caught up on anything in this environment. So I'm a big fan of owning gold and selling stocks today, and I think that will be a helpful portfolio allocation for to manage risk during this period.
Makes sense. In fact, I've got a chart that you might enjoy, Tabby, that is both gold against Amazon. You mentioned the mega caps that have strong valuations, and we see weakness for the consumer. It's still over 50% of Amazon's money is the retail man in the streets. So we actually have a Amazon divided by precious metals pair. That's just an interesting proxy for us. Let me just see if I can dig that out again to share, because it's quite interesting when you do the entire period of Amazon's original foundation. It obviously had a very big bullish period where it was chronically overperforming, and then subsequently it underperformed. I think we have that right here. Let's see if I can get that for you. There we go. I've already annotated this chart. We had what we called, we have an upside structure that we particularly like trading and investing on. And it's a squeeze, it's a volatility squeeze. And we inferred that Amazon was an outperformer from the 2008, 9, 10 period as a result of this. I'm not sure if you're seeing this. So your guidance in essence is actually you get good liquidity on the mega caps. They're overvalued. You might have Nvidia on your sites as well. I don't know. I don't want to speak for you as a value hyper overvaluation. But that period was a great time to be net long Amazon and actually not in gold. And you had this hypervaluation extending of Amazon versus gold all the way through to our target. That's the purple line up top there. And that was a decade long plus trade. I mean, you were here 2010. You only really got away properly in 12, and you made our targets in about 2022. So as a macro fund strategist, you would have biased long the tech, especially the consumer tech site of Amazon, for example. What we've seen subsequently, though, that seems to support your hypothesis is that we're calling that there's a potential for a reversal in this. Now, it has had a little bit of a rally because gold has done reasonably poorly. I think it's coming into season with September. I'd be interested in your view. But if I just drop this down to the weekly time frame and we just have a look more recently, it's quite clear that Amazon is no longer making the same headway against this, and we've drawn possibility of a head and shoulder structure. It's only invalidated up top here, and we have a neckline roundabout there. We think at some point this rolls over, and it feels like your supposition that the equity markets are not very far away but from being forced into a reality check. At one point, there was about 15% of the, and I can't recall the date I got the stat, and I suspect it's only got worse, of the S&P's constituents that are actually borrowing to make dividend payments. Do you have any data and comments on that? Surely as rates climb, this should be turning into also another ticking bomb in terms of these, in terms of your views.
So let's address some of your points. And I just, we start with NVIDIA. I think everything is hyped, obviously, in this space. NVIDIA perhaps is the only one that actually can back it up with fundamental improvement, significant fundamental improvement. I think their free cash flow estimate, this is not actual actual numbers, is supposed to be increased by now almost quadruple. Did it get ahead of itself? I think so. But can we find other companies that have added a lot of market cap value without having any fundamental backup? And yes, the answer is certainly yes. And one of them would be Apple. Apple certainly is part of those, of the mega cap side that has, I think, free cash flow estimates for Apple for 2 years out is supposed to be flat. That is, you know, still a consumer discretionary business at the end of the day, that, you know, I'm very concerned. I mean, it's got, dependency with China and so forth. I mean, there are so many ways things can go wrong with the stock, and it has added about $1 trillion year to date, and recently is starting to come off. So that is one. Amazon is interesting because you know, we have a fund model here at Crescent that we looked at 50 different fundamental factors to see what companies score across the globe. And Amazon is one of the worst, actually, FANG stocks that we have in our model. And so for many reasons, you know, I think that Amazon have had some very pivotal moments recently when it comes to the way they've been running the company. If you notice, and a lot of people will say, well, that's normal, they're just investing. But Amazon, while it invested large amounts of money in the past and have run the business in a negative profitability way in the past, what we're seeing today is unprecedented amounts of CapEx relative to how much money they make, in which, you know, I don't think this has been the case in the past at all. I mean, if you look at the history of CapEx of Amazon, we haven't really seen that level of investment. So something is off from that perspective, and in line with what you said about the consumer part of the business, but also even the AWS part of the business as well, which has been suffering from increasing competition. I think at some point mega caps, especially Amazon, will come under pressure. And so, we're short Amazon, we're short Apple, we're short Microsoft, and I think we're even short Nvidia as well. But I think that the size of those positions will depend on the cost of how to short them, because, you know, Apple, for instance, is the cheapest to be short. It was 2 weeks ago, but it still is very cheap relative to the implied volatility of those options and so forth. Amazon and Microsoft, let's see, Microsoft and Google falls into the next category of cheapness of derivatives. And so that's kind of, you know, how, you know, I kind of try to think about how to really protect the portfolio in terms of those risks.
Yes, it's interesting to do that, because I think, how do you reconcile this with a hyperstagflationary environment? We've kind of coined this phrase. In essence, we've got a crushed consumer. So this is sort of 70s on steroids, only much more indebtedness. So people often want to do associative thinking and just say, well, it's the 70s. And that's actually kind of sloppy, because there's a lot of additional aspects that are far more finely balanced today and far more excessive in some ways. So it's almost a hyperstagflation. We've got a consumer getting crushed on the one hand, which is a demand curve that's getting for price, getting pushed this way. And then at the same time, we've got a devaluation of money that is going in a chronic manner. So we almost have these two very diametrically opposed forces. I sometimes refer to a mom and a dad walking, holding the baby's hand and saying, today we now have a bulldozer on one side and a combine harvester pulling the child's hand on the other. And you can say they're balanced, but the degree of force is so much larger that the scope for something to go wrong and for the limbs to be pulled out are really, really far more tenuous. How do people buy us? Because it's kind of confusing. In some senses, the stock market has gone up as an inflation trade. Where do you put your money? I mean, if you leave it in the bank, you're getting below, you know, even on BLS numbers, which no one believes or trusts, you're getting a below return. You're guaranteeing going backwards. If the crypto market has been properly hammered, so retail crypto is wrecked, the SEC is continuing to cause confusion in terms of the institutional involvement there. So it's kind of been put on ice. The commodity trade is the inflation trade. It's largely accepted. But funny enough, you're not getting this investment. And we haven't really seen the great moves yet. People are feeling that they have to be as patient as a nun on gold. Since the first 2,000 runs, we've had two more, giving us a total of three and a pullback. How much longer before the actual inflation element comes? And when the demand-destroying event hits and we have a real crash, is that commodities not first going to sell off in the disinflationary force first? So are people still prone? How do we get the timing of that right, in essence, given that we've got these such powerful diametrically opposing forces? How would you talk to someone about that strategically and positioning?
Well, first, I would use the lenses of an inflationary time and think about how inflation develops through waves, and doesn't matter if it's an indebted period or a less indebted period. And you can see inflation also develop through waves in the 40s and 30s. And so it's an interesting way of thinking, because that also occurred in emerging markets. If you look at how Brazil or Turkey or Argentina, Venezuela, all those, or Germany in the early 20s, all those places had some level of waves in their inflationary periods, which that's how they developed throughout history. And so what is interesting to me about all that is that, you know, when you think about what happens during inflationary times, which I think we're in one today, you know, we tend to see a compression of multiples. And that compression of multiples happens for many reasons. And that is one, because of cost of capital being so high. Number two, it could have to do with margins getting squeezed. Cost of living might be out of line with how much people make in their wages. As they require higher wages and salaries, you start to see companies getting squeezed in terms of their margins. That is certainly what we're seeing today. You know, and when you think about the last decade since the 2010s, it was the most robust growth of earnings that we've had in history in real terms. And, you know, we've had other comparable times, which was two other decades that we had very robust earnings, and they preceded very contrarian, basically, completely opposite decades. They basically preceded, you know, complete opposite decades in terms of growth. So those are the early 20s and the 90s. And so the growth of the internet and the technology companies of the 90s created a very robust period of growth and earnings, believe it or not, in real terms. And the subsequent decade, which was the early 2000s or the 2000s until 2010, was one of the worst periods for corporate growth earnings that we've had in history. The second one was the one that followed the Great Depression. And so, you know, when you think in those terms, you know, number one, it's concerning that we just had one, you know, by far the most robust period of growth in fundamentals. And people extrapolating again that we're going to see another decade like that. We've never seen two back-to-back decades of robust growth in fundamentals. So, you know, I think this is not in line with multiples. The only way to justify what we have in the markets right now is if we're entering another period of low cost of capital, along with very strong growth in general. And so I disagree with those views. I think we're not going to see that. I think we're going to see the opposite of that. And compression of multiples is still ahead of us. And once we see that, I think we're going to realize why people like, you know, Stanley Druckenmiller and some other investors have already said that perhaps we're not going to see, you know, the same returns that we've had in the last decade return again this following one. And so I'm quite concerned about those unrealistic expectations of investors today in the markets.
Yeah, there's that exponential world school of thought where AI is revolutionizing everything and we're going to have this unparalleled degree of growth. And I do agree with you, there's excess optimism in terms of what that actually means for asset valuations. And I want to highlight that I think you're meaning major US compression on multiples, but the scope for Brazilian, I had the Bovespa up for a while, and other where you only have very moderate, and Russia for that matter as well, and other markets like it, and Kazakhstan, the stands, where you're getting more corporatocracy, you're getting a little bit more rule of law. America is actually moving away from rule of law a little bit in some people's opinions in the more recent history, that you're actually going to see rather the compression of America lead multiples leading to a bit of improvement in the very low multiples in the emerging markets, such as those that you've mentioned. Yeah. Is that
absolutely. I mean, just do yourself a favor and look at the chart of Brazilian real versus the Japanese yen, or Brazilian real versus the Chinese yuan and so forth. Those are import or commodities.
If I may interject, the Mexican peso against the dollar has been in the nonstop bull market. I think it's got a bit of a friend-shoring tailwind. In fact, you brought up the yen, and I'm going to jump on that. Surely, and we haven't spoken much about FX. Surely, and I'm amazed because I watched Druckenmiller like you. I'm a fan. He's got a lovely manner. He's got this, you know, this humility performance and the wry grin that makes him very likable. But surely, he said, I can't see. It's the hardest market. Surely, the short yen trade, given their position on the debt and the fact that they are not holders of the exorbitant privilege of currency, has to be the key thing. I actually was in advance of this. This is going to bring up our euro-yen trade. This is our macro call for, and this is not against the currency we like, by the way, or rate economically, but it is the counterbalancing point of the dollar, the euro, and we actually see the scope for unbelievable movements in FX, which is very untypical because as an FX trader, you know, grab 50 pips a day and you've done a great day's work. This particular chart, we're suggesting 230s and beyond for yen as target. Surely their position on their debt by doing their yield curve control makes the currency valve the only valve for the release of the pressure that coincides with their overall position. And doesn't that make that the short of the decade as an FX trade?
I have a view of certainly that the Japanese yen will probably continue to be pressured lower for many reasons, but I rather make that short relative to an exporter of commodities, which have significantly underperformed over the last decade or so relative to commodity importers for the right reasons. And so to me, you know, if I look at a cross of Brazilian real versus net importer of commodities, it is very clear that those have been in a downward trend, is starting to break out from those trends recently and breaking some very major resistances, you know, across, you know, you can be looking at 15, 20 years out. And it's really interesting how those currencies are starting to price in, you know, a potential much bigger move of Brazilian real versus those economies. So I get really excited about that. I also, my concern about being short the Japanese yen with the dollar is that it is difficult to be bullish the dollar as well, because it,
not a dollar. I wouldn't use the dollar. We've got the technical setup on the euro, but it's actually also on the franc. And there's other, and I like your emerging idea trade for the reasons that you've already outlined. We actually don't have such a clear trade. We think it's weak against everything, but you're going to have sustained period of dollar weakness as well. I mean, pivoting that, we've got the BRICS showing up August 22. And I'm a born South African. It's in Johannesburg, South Africa. And I've just read an article today. They've invited 69 other nations that are not part of the original gangsters, if you want to, of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa itself. Which means a very inclusive and stay abreast of what we're doing, and maybe the possibility of further expansionism in there, and certainly playing a very open role. What are you anticipating out of that? And do you have any ideas, any plays that on that news event specific? What are they going to announce? We both, I assume, don't expect convertibility to gold, but we may expect some degree of vague tying to commodity-based backing and of assets.
Look, I don't have any insights on that in particular. I mean, as far as I try to follow what's happening as far as, you know, BRICS and other potential ways of becoming a more multipolar world, and I think that's going to be the answer for all this. I do think there is a really big trend of central banks enhancing the quality of their international reserves. Ultimately, any central bank must hold high quality assets in order to create credibility to their monetary system. You know, we think about the most credible monetary systems in the world today, as of now, are the ones that hold a significant amount of US treasuries. They have a way to back up their currencies in a large way. But as we see treasury markets come with weakness over time, I think that shift will come towards gold. And that doesn't necessarily mean those economies need to be packed against gold, but ultimately that disciplinary approach is going to have to be reached as well. But I think first would be just enhancing the quality of those reserves over time is probably the trend that we're likely to see. And now what is also interesting is that when you start seeing central banks make such a big move of selling treasuries or just adding on a net basis gold relative to treasuries over time, it is also likely that we're going to see other 60-40 portfolios and other large institutions follow along the same way. They are always kind of having a lagging effect. And we did that. We saw that in the 80s when treasuries become, they've gotten really cheap during the early 80s, given how yields were higher and we're already saw a decade long of inflation and we're entering a disinflationary environment. That was the right time to be buying treasuries, and some central banks did very well, you know, in the Europe area. Certainly we saw that. Japan certainly did that as well. Canada, Australia, and others. But now, certainly we're seeing the other side of that. It's the beginning of an inflationary era where other central banks are starting to figure that out, and we're seeing larger and larger economies starting to accumulate that. So although I don't have a lot of insights on, you know, any block currency, any things like that, and different settlements in the FX world, I do think it's a multipolar kind of environment, but also where the enhancing of quality of reserves will be playing a big role, and gold is going to be probably that big alternative for those instruments over time, for those institutions over time. So, yeah.
I want to take you to gold and silver, because it's something you're again very bullish on. But as I say, for now, kind of not been particularly great, particularly silver, which is lagging. We've got the gold silver ratio back up at 84 after threatening a bit of a sell-off. What do you say to the people that say, man, I've heard all for decades about how I should be buying silver? In fact, I remember shorting silver at around $35 on a head and shoulder over here on that rally. And now today, that's some 10, 12 years later, we're sitting at $22, and we've created more dollars in that time than anybody knows, including just CV19 being 6 or 7 trillion. There was the bank bailouts that probably ran into about 22 trillion. We've been hearing about the supplies. I'm being deliberately the devil's advocate here, by the way. I'm a big bull and I'm positioned in silver, but the people that would say also, look, we've been hearing about the above ground supplies that are always going to be on the verge of running out. And don't forget, we've had solar panels that's proliferating in countries like South Africa. Even, you know, less obvious nations are doing all of this. It's got a lot of silver content, but yet the silver price is sitting at $22.6. And it hit $50 once in the 80s. It hit close to 50 in 2011. And we're sitting here 12 years later, where inflation has to be one of the most core key fulcrums, and we're sitting at $22. How did we get to be this low?
Well, there's a lot of reasons why, although it surprised me as well. Whenever I talk about silver, I think a lot of people like to say how much it has underperformed over the last decade. And my answer to that is I wasn't involved with silver in 2011 or 2010. I was really not involved with that at all. And if you're a macro investor, the reason of something has underperformed in the last decade or so is precisely the reason why it should be in your radar. It's the same thing with Brazilian equities. I mean, looked at how they did, you know, since the global financial crisis relative to the S&P 500. Terrible, you know, and that's the whole reason why this should be in front of you right now. And so to me, you know, we've had the Fed really fight with tooth and nail inflation recently, and I think that had an impact in some commodities. I've never seen a time in history when there is a gold secular move and silver doesn't follow or in fact leads the market. And I should also point out that it's not just silver. I mean, if you looked at the chart of gold, once you get a real movement that is a long-term trend, one should also look at agricultural commodities. One should also look at copper. You should also look at nickel and silver, and all the other commodities tend to be interconnected. And so this is a reason why I get excited for anything that is really cheap. And when I looked at us being on the verge of a gold cycle. Now I looked at gold and there's a triple top and everybody's so skeptical. And, we see a breakout from gold, you know, up to adding, I don't know, $500 an ounce on top of where you're looking at right now. It would surprise a lot of people. What do you think silver would do in that environment? Probably it will go, you know, back to the prior highs of the 50s. So, and potentially have some resistance and then break out from there. You know, that's most likely the scenario. So I expect that we're going to see that, as I'm patient. I'm not, you know, I'm okay. I've actually been looking for resource businesses that have high quality silver over the last 2 to 3 years. even purchased the eighth largest silver mine in the world, and you know, through a private investment. And that is, you know, to me, that's a much bigger and more relevant way of capitalizing in this idea. I think, you know, it's completely out of love, and nobody is really spending focusing time and energy in this potential thesis. And to me, it's one of the most important ones to create wealth. And so I think gold will break out, but that's not the biggest trade here. I think there's other things that will follow along that will be even more appealing from an asymmetry perspective.
That's a great insight. I try often, because we sit very similarly camped in the commodity, and I think, how do we be wrong on the macro commodity long play? And there's only one scenario that I've been able to come up. Unfortunately, it could, amongst the more conspiratorial minds, potentially be a case for this. If we were to have a grassroots right sizing of the total, and this, forgive me, this is a bit of left field thinking, because I truly don't see any obvious problems with the inflation trade. If we were to have a substantial reduction in global population, that could be very abrupt. That may be warfare related. It might be pandemic related. Let's not go too much further than that into the weeds. Demographic cycle, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the overall level of demands suddenly gets significantly right-sized down. This inflation that we are suddenly experiencing, the current levels of output would then more than suffice, and we could actually get some degree of disinflation on your coffee beans, your, you know, the solar panels. There's much less homes that need it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Am I wrong to be thinking that far and wide? And would that hypothesis hold if we lost, let's just say, comet, asteroid hits the world, without getting into any weeds of crazy thoughts, zombie apocalypse? Surely that would be the only element that could bring, and would it bring, the inflationary narrative back under control? In that existing supply would now be more than abundant, and we may even go into what would be like a glut, like the artificially created glut that occurred in oil when we had the whole shutdown. In essence, that is an example of how you kill level of demand for travel and oil and burning. We've already had a microcosm of that. Were we to get that again, does that? What's your take on that? Would it not have the same effect of killing the inflation trade?
Well, I think the answer for inflation is, you know, potentially has that. I mean, it's, I struggle when I see, you know, I've heard obviously this argument, and I really have issues when I hear one single factor type of argument on macro, because understanding how things work, it is such a multi-vector way of analyzing things that, you know, that to me seems, and I know you're not making that point, but it's just, it seems very incomplete and not accurate on, you know, looking back in history. When I think about ways that economies have done so well in the past, I can probably say that there's really three main reasons. Technology is one of them. When there's, you know, incredible technological advancements can create growth. Number two, population growth is another one. And it's another factor. It's not the main one, but it's one of them. The other one is a resource favorable market that can also create growth for an economy. That's a third one that I think it's important. You know, I remember so well during the beginning of inflation, the biggest counter argument for inflation recently used to be money velocity. And money velocity is an important factor. Is that the only thing we should be looking at? No. It's the one thing you should put in your model and say, all right, well, that's not checking here along with other things. But when somebody over relies on one factor, it's always an issue. So AI will probably be an interesting way to solve inflation.
I mean, I'm just saying, what if they were right?
It is.
I mean, AI and robotics suddenly blossom. All the chips have been hoovered up, and now we've got robot dog doing your vacuuming and all your things, and so many things start to get automated. And let me just say, there's lots of climate lockdowns, there's lots of right downsizing of overall activity in terms of movement and everything else like that. These disinflationary forces, would they be disinflation? That's my opinion, but maybe you disagree. And surely, could they find a way out of this built-up potential inflation? We've got a canister that wants to explode, in my opinion, in terms of this inflation. I'm totally on board with your view. This is a stress testing game theory thought exercise rather than a probability, a very high rated probability. But you have to ask all these questions if you're going to long hold with very deep stops, assets in far off lands that don't have a long history of rule of law, et cetera, because they grow tropical fruits in Brazil and because, you know, on low multiples. Can they stay low multiples forever? You can call bottoms, you can be way too early, and they can never actually turn. And the hype train on AI actually turns out true to a degree, because in some senses, the dot-com boom was true. It just got too fast too soon. It corrected. Yeah. And then you got Amazon, you got Google, you got all of them. And now it's rolling into AI. Should we not have a little bit of the magic dust of the tech? Is there not some of the exponential error in your idealized portfolio that you should have? And could some of that inflation trade get decimated by that exponential everything? These bull optimists, could they be in part right?
Well, number one, I love stress testing ideas. And I think AI would be a huge breakthrough in general. It's been one, but it's even from a debt perspective. I mean, when I think about what's really causing the debt problem, in a lot of ways, is related to healthcare. It's related to, think about the healthcare part of it and the debt that we have from, unfunded liabilities from Social Security, Medicaid, and so forth. Yeah. When you consider the fact that majority of that cost comes from service, literally it does. It comes from service, and we likely won't be paying doctors as much as we did because of AI, because of all the tools that are being created. Will doctors get paid the same that they are today, 20 years from now? Probably not. What does that mean to the debt problem? Well, it'll probably get better. And so these are all long-term trends. I mean, they're going to take a decade or so. I mean, if we're going to have robots replacing humans, we're going to need a lot of resources to build those things, we're not going to build them. They're not going to be imaginary things. They're going to need resources. I mean, it's like software is going to change the world, but we can't just eat software. We need food. We need other things to make those shifts. And so I am a firm believer that AI is a real trend, just like internet was. A lot more than crypto, in my opinion, way more. Blockchain and all that. But I also think that this is going to take a while. I don't think I'm going to ignore AI in the future. I would love to be an investor. I just think things are too frothy right now. Internet, as everybody knows, Amazon was down 99% during the tech bust, and it still returned to be where it is today. And so, but it's not. I'm not sure it will be the case here with a lot of those AI firms, but I think the frothiness is different this time. But I also think that, productivity will take a while to be to reflect those changes. And I don't think we're going to see a resolution of the debt problem anytime soon. And if that's the case, central banks will continue to buy gold. And if that's the case, then commodities will probably do very well. If people are buying gold, that means geopolitically, things are getting heating up. And if that's the case, then we're going to see less reliance in other economies. If that's the case, we're probably going to see more manufacturing construction. And then you look at housing, everything is expensive. How do we fix the housing problem? We got to build, or we get, materials to build. Well, we need resources, we need commodities. And so I don't think this is the end of that trend at all. I think this is the very beginning. Could I be wrong? Yeah, I've been wrong in the past. Very high.
My challenge to the housing issue is they've been financialized. If the debt dies, the pricing dies. And is it really that there's a lack of property, or is it overpriced? Is there a lot of purchase property standing empty? And if you have some degree of population reduction on top of that, then actually property as an asset class, we're already seeing the decimation in commercial property. Property as a residential asset class could be, especially say in the States where it's very fully priced, the UK is very fully priced. You're getting a demographic downturn naturally without any major events. You get a couple of accelerants like the pandemics and old age homes. You could, and then that you get the debt, the financialization of everything unraveling. I could see disinflationary forces. That's my main argument. And these elements, the minute your property start costing less, the inflationary elements, the rentals, those things could adjust downwards.
That
could
take some of the heat. Why are house prices expensive? I don't look at house prices. I don't look at any asset price by one angle. I think you have to look at relative to something. So, I just don't look at the price of the S&P 500 and say, oh, it's too high. I'm going to, it's time to sell it. It has to be relative to profits, help relative to other assets. So, why would house prices be expensive today relative to how much they cost? Or, I actually think the housing price in general or housing market is a lot more in line with the cost itself than the S&P 500 or NASDAQ or anything like that. I would even argue that if I was starting today with my 401k, I would rather own a house than own the S&P 500 for the next 10 years, because I think our deal will be better trade.
The commodity input costs are getting more and more expensive, and I agree. New builds is going to be real, real expensive. I absolutely agree. Give us your final and closing thoughts, Tavi, before I give you an opportunity to direct our audience to find your services. What's the 5-bullet-point plan for positioning for this era that you would give our listeners right now?
5-bullet-point plan. I wasn't prepared for this answer, so I'm going to try to answer.
Take your card.
That's way. So, look, I can't start but not thinking about risk. And number one, I would be cautious about how expensive valuations are in parts of the market that this is just not sustainable. I don't know when it's going to happen. I wish I had that answer, but I don't have an answer for that. So, but would I put my money on technology today and close my eyes for the next 5 years? No, I would not do that. That's just not what I would do. So that would be bullet point number one. Bullet point number two, where would I put my money? I think gold is, if you're looking for something that will be likely safe and that will protect your portfolio during downturns for the next 5 years. Yeah, I think gold would be that asset more than treasuries. I think we may see even an environment where treasuries decline with gold increasing, which happened in 2022, and I think it could happen going forward. Number three,
about exposure to debt and interest rates for people, everyday people that might have mortgage loans. Are you concerned for that side of things? Should people be removing debt?
What do you mean by that? Sorry, just understand.
Personal debt, personal cost of personal debt for individuals.
Well, I think we're going to enter an environment of structurally higher rates and, I think it's going to be very stressful to run a business that requires a lot of leverage. I think there's going to be business models that are just not going to work, that worked in the last 10 years that will work. I don't think Uber, for instance, Uber is now becoming profitable, but back 5 years or a year ago or so, I'm not sure that model of Uber would have worked in the 70s, right? Why? Because it's too much leverage. You can't just run a business like that. Nike almost went bankrupt in the 70s because of leverage. And so, it's a phenomenal business, right? So it is going to clean up a lot of that in terms of businesses are going to have to be a lot more robust to endure those environments. And that will serve to people as well. And, we'll be able to run with a lot of personal debt. But honestly, households are not as indebted as you would think. So the data doesn't show that as much. I'm more concerned about government debt than personal debt personally.
Okay.
I think that's an issue. So bullet point number three would be probably, a hard thought about commodities. I would really plan to think about commodity producers, explorers, developers, think about which underlying commodities, try to really understand that market very well. I think becoming an expert of that would be a skill set that will be in demand for the next decade or 5 years or so, 3 years or so. Bullet point number four would be related to number three, but not necessarily, which is understanding economies that may benefit from that, especially the ones that are really cheap right now, Brazil being one of them, but Brazil is just one. I mean, South America in general is resource rich and may offer great opportunities. If the Brazil trade is right, then the Argentina trade is right. And most likely the Peruvian trade is right. And most likely the Bolivian trade is right. And so you can extrapolate that and really think about how to position your portfolio. And number five, I would suggest investors to learn about value investing. I would suggest investors to learn about how to value a business, how to understand what a business is worth. What is a business that have a moat, or that has a moat, and which means just having a competitive advantage of other over others? What are types of competitive advantages that are long-term ways to manage, to invest in a business that is successful? Understanding how Warren Buffett made money, which is something that people mocked him recently and so forth. And, I would suggest you to, learn more about that, because I think that would be a very, very good way to manage money. Value investing.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. You actually triggered one point, and I'll just throw this in before we let you sign off. We have an opinion that gold, follow the gold, and Kissinger said that gold moving from west to east. We've certainly seen China go become the biggest producer and also the biggest importer from Africa. I know a lot of dark gold is making its way that way as well via Dubai and the Middle East. We have a feeling that there's going to be capital formation moving from the traditional hubs of New York, listings and capital formation and London, whilst they won't disappear entirely, towards the Middle East and Singapore. And Singapore being maybe the acceptable face for the demographics, which has the younger generation, the next positive demographics, Indonesia, Malaysia. You've spoken quite a bit about Latin America, but I'm just interested in your take, for example, those low PE companies potentially in those parts of the world, and the fact that those that are really champions that end up getting listing possibly in the Singapore market, could we not see getting in front of that capital surge if we are seeing a dissipation away from super pricey US markets and also debt conflation? Could we not see also getting in front of a very good wave in terms of that direction? Or are you more pro the Latin America that you've already emphasized?
I happen to be more, have more insights on South America because I'm from there. But I think there's incredible opportunities to do the same in Asia. I don't think China is that country at all. I think China is almost like the no-go of all those. But outside of that, you mentioned Indonesia and Malaysia and others. I think those are, it's an incredible way to also become an expert of those markets. Any young person looking to find your way in the business, I found my way in the business through commodities and emerging markets and other things. Do that in Asia. That could be, I think that would be a great skill set to have. And not only that, but opportunities to invest. I just happen to understand the South American, region way better than other parts of the world. And I think that would be a great skill set to have in the next 5 years. And I will leverage that on my side. But you know, if you're not in that position, if you're in a position where you understand the Asian market much better, I'm interested. You know, I think that would be a place where I would be interested in investing. Japan is not in my list. China is not in my list. But even Australia and Canada, honestly, I mean, they're resource rich economies. They are indebted. So, you know, I think you can find other countries that don't have debt to a certain degree that those countries have that potentially could do even better. But, you know, there's hair in everything. I mean, you know, saying I'm going to invest in Brazil with Lula in it, you know, it's not an easy trade. It's you know, you're going to have to get your arms around the political environment. And that would be the case with Indonesia and Malaysia and so forth. So, yeah, but I think there's times to be investors of those places, and potentially this is the time now.
I agree. And it helps, obviously, you being a Spanish speaker. With that devaluation of the yen, are we not going to also see an overshoot of valuation of high potential picking off or appreciation in the Nikkei 225? Because you're going to see an epic currency devaluation if we are both accurate on the loss of value and the continuing skidding of the yen. However, you have very high quality macro that have big export markets that essentially are yen hedge plays corporations. This has been a theme we really, really liked. And I've just, I suppose, stress test the idea with you. Some of the things like Sony, you know, Fujitsu, Honda, Suzuki, etc., megacorps. We've seen a lot of very positive technical setups that we've liked on them. Does the counter for their currency travails not also set them up for some? I mean, we've got a through the previous highs, almost to the doorstep of 60,000 on the Nikkei, but this is obviously in devalued yen. So could proxy plays, where you don't take the devaluation of the yen, but you take derivative options on the long side for some of these export yen hedge plays, not turn out a good theme as well?
I think it's very possible. It's not on the top of my list, although I know Warren Buffett is heavily invested in Japan and other value investors too. And I completely understand the idea of the debasement of the currency potentially helping some of those businesses. I think I have principles the way I invest, and I think you do as well. And my opinion is the following. I don't go all in on things that are expensive, and I don't short, and I don't go all in short things that are really cheap. And so, you know, what does that mean? I mean, I'm not going to buy technology businesses, and they're never going to be a large percentage of my portfolio at those valuations that they are currently. I may own one or two, maybe Palantir and some other ones that are more, you know, potentially in better valuations and so forth. But, you know, overall, it's never going to become a large percentage of my portfolio because I understand the risk. You know, they're priced for perfection. The other way around is important too. You know, Japanese equities are really cheap. Would I short them? No way. It's not my... it's just not a huge, you know, it's not a huge focus of mine. And the reason for that is because I'm much more interested in resource businesses. I'm more interested in getting it right on the macro side of that trend. And the same thing goes for China. You know, I very much not a believer of China, but when I look at the equity market in China, is really cheap. And so, you know, would I short it? No, unfortunately, it's just not in my radar right now. So it's something I'm avoiding. I think there's a potential for devaluation of the yuan and so forth, and a lot of other things. But yeah, it's hard. There's so many ways to skin the cat here and make money.
I agree. And I think if I were to summarize your take, the commodity plays, the people, the producers of physical things that are needed are very central to you, and the very low valuations that are associated with that. You mentioned the Brazilian Vespa a couple of times, and similar markets to Brazil as well around there. Fabi, I've really enjoyed sharing with you, and thank you for your very cutting insights. Everyone should give you a follow, first of all, on Twitter. If you can shout out your Twitter handle again for us, at?
My Twitter handle is @TabiCosta. And thanks again for having me. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
And for people that wish to engage get your services and any reports and feeds with you, is there any mailing list? Which website should they go to engage with you further?
Prescott.net is my website, and you can learn about our business there. There's a lot of letters if you're looking for research letters and any information about the funds that we run. We run a global macro long short in a precious metals fund. If you're interested in investing, you know, you can just get in touch through our website. There's all the information there, Prescott.net.
That's fabulous. We'll put those links in below. Check out the excellent work that's going on and the beautiful visual representations as well as we go through this crazy reset economics. Thank you so much for your time, Tavi. Have a great day and thanks for coming on.
You as well. Take care.